This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Transformers, The Last Knight, The Beguiled, and The Book of Henry. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to talk about is actually something, it kind of set the internet on fire because it was a piece of news that we weren't expecting to get at this point, and it seems about 6 months too late. Apparently, the toxicology report on Carrie Fisher when she passed was released. And what I found fascinating about this wasn't even what was in the toxicology report, but rather people's reaction and the interest in this. And just to put it out there, the toxicology report found cocaine, it found a whole cocktail of drugs, cocaine, methadone, ecstasy, alcohol, opiates, a whole bunch of things in her system after she was rushed to the hospital on a flight. Now, if you recall, when she passed away back in December, the cause of death was attributed to sleep apnea, which I thought was kind of an odd diagnosis, because sleep apnea, while it can be a dangerous condition, it usually is not what kills you. In a weird way, it's kind of like AIDS. AIDS doesn't kill you. What happens is AIDS suppresses the immune system to a point that some other disease kills you, like pneumonia. And sleep apnea doesn't necessarily kill you, but it puts a strain on the heart. It puts a strain on blood pressure. It makes you more susceptible to stroke. It makes you more susceptible to a heart attack, and those sort of things. And that's usually what ends up killing you. It's not choking in your sleep. And those people that I've ever heard dying of sleep apnea, somebody like Andre the Giant, who was ginormous. I mean, he was like 500 pounds and he was 7 feet tall. He had giganticism. He was abnormally large. And so for his throat to close up and not be able to breathe while he was sleeping and ultimately suffocate, that makes sense. Doesn't make sense for Carrie Fisher. I mean, yeah, she was older and she was a little heavier than she was back when she made the original Star Wars movies, but that seemed like such an odd diagnosis. And after reading a little bit about it, it makes sense. It was sort of methadone, which is a synthetic or sort of like a heroin substitute. It was like methadone and alcohol and this mixture of maybe even opiates that caused her responses, her body responses to not breathe when they were supposed to. These are all depressants that slow motor functions and nerves and muscles. So that is actually more likely what caused her death. Now, I know a lot of people went bonkers over this and was like, it's none of your business. Who cares what she does? She's still our princess and we love her. And then look, this is nothing against Carrie Fisher. And here's the thing. If Carrie Fisher were alive, she'd look at you right in the eye and be like, yeah, I was taking drugs. Because Carrie Fisher has had a long history of drug use and drug abuse. And she has also been, over the years, ever since she kind of got out of it in the 80s and kind of became a writer and got her life back on track, she was very open about it. She was very open about the fact that she had serious problems with substances. And she even joked, I once saw her, I think it was like David Letterman or Jay Leno way back in the day, and she's like, she joked about saying, hey, I got my mom's acting ability and my dad's drug abuse issues. So this is nothing new, and it was nothing new for Carrie Fisher. And you know, is it any of our business? No, not really. But here's the thing. When you're a celebrity, especially a celebrity at that level, and an active celebrity, had this been 5 years ago, it would be very different because Carrie Fisher had kind of disappeared into obscurity. She even still wrote, but the stuff that she wrote the most was in the 80s and 90s, you know, Postcards from the Edge and Surrender the Pink and all that kind of stuff. Nowadays, she really was a lesser known figure and she was in her 60s, so she was, you know, winding down. But then she started doing Star Wars movies again, and that puts it on your radar. And she's a celebrity, and this is the trade-off. Unfortunately, whether or not you think it's right to pry into somebody like Carrie Fisher's personal history, when you become that level of celebrity, you surrender a certain level of privacy. I mean, the same thing happened with Heath Ledger. People are like, well, he's so young. You know, why did he die? Oh my gosh, let's look at Heath Ledger. And so they wanted to know what killed him. Same thing with Prince. Now, like when Adam West died, or last year when Christopher Lee died in 93 or something like that. I don't think anyone was questioning that because you're like, yeah, you're 93. You're lucky to make it to the next day at that point. Adam West was what, like 88? When Roger Moore died, and I think he died of cancer. But even then, when Roger Moore died, I mean, I don't think anybody was questioning and saying, oh, he's so young. I mean, you know, when you get in your 80s and 90s, that's when you expect to pass away. Early 60s is still pretty young to die. And I think that it's important to note this because for whatever reason she was on these drugs are not good for you. And for as much as there are some people who say we should legalize all drugs, you know, cocaine, methadone, ecstasy, opiates, and then even mix that all with alcohol, which is legal, drugs have a huge impact. And she spent a lot of her life taking drugs. That's not a judgment. That's just a reality. But this is what can happen to you. So this is a cautionary tale. And I think ultimately a sober Carrie Fisher would look at this and be like, yes, this is a good message. Don't take all these drugs and go to sleep on a plane. I mean, this is what can happen to you. So, and we got some answers, and we also got a reason why she died at such a young age, relatively young age, at like 62. That's really it on the movie news. There's another piece of news I'm going to talk about later. I'm sure everybody can guess what it is, but right now I need to move on into something new. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Annabelle Creation. This is, of course, the sequel to Annabelle. It opens on August 11th.
This is our new orphanage. Wow, this is big as a castle.
Sister, you always say that even though we can't see God, we can feel his presence. In this house, I feel a different kind of presence. An evil one. It's coming after me. Because I'm the weakest.
August 11th is an odd time to release a sequel like this because the first one, I think the first one came out in September, which is a really terrible time to release movies. August can be okay, but it's August 11th is in sort of that netherworld between is it going to be a big hit or is it going to be just filling out time until school starts? And now there's a weird history of horror movies doing pretty well in August. So this might work. I mean, if you recall the Rob Zombie version of Halloween, as terrible as that was released in August. And we've seen horror films released in the August timeframe that have actually worked as well and done well. So this one looks good. Actually, it looks better than the first one. What's funny about this is it reminds me a little bit of the Ouija series. The first Ouija was not very good. The second one actually is not a bad movie. In terms of setting up the story, maybe it's this period piece element, but you know, the second movie was actually better than the first. And in this one, this the sequel to Annabelle might actually be better. And it looks pretty creepy. And I'm looking forward to this one. This might be one of those surprise hits of the summer. The next one I want to talk about is Daddy's Home 2, which opens November 10th.
Hey guys, we got a big surprise for you.
Oh, is it money? A trampoline? Another pony?
This year, Christmas, both families together.
Yay!
Hello? Grandpa Kurt?
Look, your father hasn't met the new Evolve Dusty.
That's exactly the stuff he's going to make fun of us for. You'll see.
Dear God.
Look who's here!
Tell
the
Papa Joe!
Hey, kids, I got a good one for you. Two dead hookers wash up on the shore.
Oh, no.
I've actually never seen the first one. The first one came out like that Christmas that Star Wars The Force Awakens came out, and I had so many screenings to go to, and I'd already gone up to like Cleveland to see Alvin and the Chipmunks, and that was the only place they were screening this, so I didn't go up a second day. So I've never seen it. I will say, if anything, this trailer makes me want to watch the first movie. Since I haven't seen it. I mean, I like Mark Wahlberg. I like Will Ferrell. I like Mel Gibson. I like John Lithgow. I like Linda Cardellini. It actually looks like a kind of funny movie. So I think my wife and I might pull up. I think it's on Amazon Prime. We might watch Daddy's Home in be in anticipation for this movie, because this one actually looks kind of funny, and maybe I actually will get a chance to see this one when it comes out in theaters, because it opens on November 10th. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the incomprehensible Transformers The Last Night.
Stop it now.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with the what's going to be the big one of the weekend, mainly because it's the only major release. And that, oh God. And that is Transformers The Last Night. Michael Bay returns to the Transformers series to make a movie about robots, a drunken wizard, lots of explosions, and a weird sexualization of a 14-year-old girl.
It started as a legend. One of the greatest of all.
A thousand years we've kept it hidden.
To protect Earth from what was destined to arrive.
Optimus Prime, you destroyed your home. Do you seek redemption?
My maker, I do. Yours must die.
I have been pretty brutal on Michael Bay over the years. I what's funny is I actually liked Bad Boys when it first came out, and I liked Armageddon. Pearl Harbor wasn't very good. It was overly bloated. You know, Michael Bay doesn't know how to do emotion. He has no emotional center, no emotional heart, because he doesn't care about characters. He cares about action movies. And he cares about the look and the style and the feel and the touch and all that. But he doesn't care about actual any sort of interaction between souls in the movie. Now, with that said, I was actually relatively kind for the first three movies. You know, the first Transformers, I was like, okay, well, it worked for what it was. The first Transformers was a goofy movie, but it did what it needed to do. And hey, you got to see the robots come to life. That was cool. And you know, it worked for what it was. It had some bad moments, like Optimus Prime trampling on rose bushes. But overall, it's a good movie. The second one, Revenge of the Fallen, was incomprehensible and a mess and had a lot of things wrong with it. But overall, at that point, again, it was like, well, it delivers on the action. I mean, you have big explosive action sequences and that's what he does. And then when he did the third movie, again, the third movie's not very good in terms of plot or characters, but I think it delivered what you needed to. I mean, and I'm like, okay, this is the third Transformers movies. We're doing a trilogy. That's fine. It had actually that last 40 minutes of the third Transformers movie was pretty impressive when it comes to action and design and the look of the film. Then he just continued making them. And when he did Transformers 4, it was just really awful and it was way too long. And it didn't even really fit together with the other three movies at all. It really felt like he was trying to push it. Now this movie, honestly, I've done radio interviews about this movie where I've tried to summarize the plot. I don't think I could summarize the plot coherently if I had a gun to my head. If you were to look at the plot on Wikipedia, I would dare you to get through the plot synopsis without feeling like you hit your head really hard. It's so convoluted of a movie, which spans from the Dark Ages with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and a drunken Merlin all the way to modern day. And apparently the Transformers have been there the whole time. You have this weird moment where they reveal, oh yeah, they've always been, oh, they've been out here during World War II, and the Transformers have just basically been here constantly. And like Bumblebee is, and I guess this seems to be like they're trying to use this as a seed to spin off the Bumblebee spinoff they're supposed to be doing. But it's so awkwardly crammed in there. And weirdly enough, this movie becomes the most convoluted King Arthur movie of the summer of 2017, which is a feat considering they had King Arthur Legend of the Sword come out just a couple weeks ago. It also has like multiple storylines. It starts off with the Dark Ages, and then it goes to the modern day, where it tries to tie it into the last movie, and then you've got Mark Wahlberg coming in, like salvaging robots in like a no man's land, where he meets this sort of street rat girl who is living there because her parents were killed, and then she disappears for like, I swear to God, an hour and 15 minutes. You never see her again until she shows up at the end. And then he's like contacted by this guy who is played by Anthony Hopkins, who has been hiding the Transformers for all this time, but also using them in massive wars. And somehow people don't remember it. And now you've got this woman who is this Arthurian legend, expert, who is like supposed to be this frumpy professor who doesn't even have a boyfriend, but she dresses like a freaking model. Even beyond that, one thing you can always say about a Michael Bay movie is his films, at least they look good. And sometimes they can be overly stylized or overly processed. Like Transformers 2 looked like, I mean, it was just like it was put in through so many filters. I mean, it looked like an Instagram post. But this movie, yeah, some of the effects are cool, but the Transformers have gotten, they've gotten so many gears and parts and pieces that they don't even look like Transformers anymore. They look like koosh balls that have been all kind of like stuck together with wires. And then on top of it, I'm sure by now you've probably heard about the shifting aspect ratio that happens. If you don't know what the aspect ratio is, on a movie, the aspect ratio is the ratio between the width of the film over the height of the film. So when you have widescreen, it's like 2.35 times as long as the vertical image on screen. Whereas like in a traditional TV is 1.33, you know, it's 1.33 as wide as it is tall. A lot of movies are either shot 2.35 or they're shot 1.85. Now, when you have like an IMAX movie, they'll shoot that almost sometimes even like a larger vertical because they shoot it on a 70 millimeter film. And if you could recall movies like The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rising, Nolan would shoot certain shots and they were shots that were done on 70 millimeter. And then when you saw them in IMAX, they really look crystal clear and amazing and sharp. And then you'd use those like for master shots. And then they go into an interior of a building and it go back to 1.85. And in some of the movies, like I believe The Dark Knight, with the scene where the Joker's shooting the truck and it flips over, I believe that whole scene is shot IMAX in IMAX film. In Dark Knight Rising, the whole bat cycle chase after they come out of the stock exchange, I believe that whole sequence was shot on IMAX. This movie has a ton of things shot on IMAX, but it's very random. I mean, it's not like an opening shot, or it's not like just the action, or it's not like just the hero shot. They do stuff like coverage. One shot is a two shot of like Anthony Hopkins and Mark Wahlberg, and then the reverse of it is kind of the same thing, or maybe a closer shot of like Anthony Hopkins, and that's the one that gets the IMAX frame. So it just pops back and forth unnecessarily and for weirdly timed shots. And that's just extremely distracting. But the thing I found most disturbing about this movie was the girl who plays the street rat character that I had mentioned before. Her name's Isabel Monor, I think is how you say her name. She's from Cleveland. But she's like 15. And in the movie, she's 14. And I would imagine she was probably about 13 or 14 when they were filming it. She is weirdly sexualized in this film. And for somebody like Michael Bay, who's at least pushing 50, that's really creepy. I mean, there's a scene. I even showed the clip from the trailer to my wife. And it shows her running. And her shirt's like needlessly tight. And it's a tank top, so you can actually see her breast bouncing. And in one scene, she's turned around, she's bending over something, you can tell she's got a lower back tattoo. I'm like, what does a 14-year-old need a tramp stamp for in a Transformers movie when she's living on the street? When did she get that? When she was 9? That shows the Lothario nature of Michael Bay, which is just so creepy and unappealing, where everything is a beer commercial, and it's uncomfortable to watch. It's sort of like there's a whole discussion in the previous film about what constituted age of consent with a teenage girl? That was oddly weird for Michael Bay to have. But the bottom line with these Transformers movies is give somebody else a chance. It's not that I think Transformers are bad. It's just that I think that there's nothing new that Michael Bay is going to get from them. But he's got a scorched earth policy where he's like, I'm going to grind this into the ground. So yeah, Transformers The Last Knight is an incomprehensible mess of hot garbage. It totally sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Beguiled and the Book of Henry.
seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse, Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. I'm going to talk about The Beguiled. It opens in like five theaters this week, which is that's a small number to talk about on the show. But I wanted to get this out there because I didn't want to get lost in the shuffle of the 4th of July week that's coming up, because I have a feeling it will be. This is a remake of a movie from 1971 with Clint Eastwood, directed by Don Siegel. And this one is directed by Sofia Coppola. A Civil War soldier from the North stumbles across a nearly deserted school for girls in Virginia, where the women and girls nurse him back to health.
If you could have anything in the world, what would it be?
To be taken far away from here.
Come with me.
He seems to be a sensitive person.
Does he?
I need rags. I need chloroform. Go to the smokehouse. Get the saw, now. Bring me the anatomy book.
Oh, what have you done to me?
The original Beguiled is a great movie. If you've not seen it, it's worth checking out. And very much like this one, it's a slow burn. It's not an action movie. There's a lot of slow character moments. And I remember when I heard that Sofia Coppola was going to be remaking the movie, I was like, well, this could be good. I mean, I have this weird relationship with Sofia Coppola's movies. Some of them I've absolutely hated. I hated Marie Antoinette. I hated Somewhere. And then there are some that I've seen that I've really enjoyed. Like, I mean, I liked Lost in Translation. I thought that was a neat story. I haven't seen all her movies. I've never seen The Virgin Suicide. So that's something I should check out at some point. But I also love The Bling Ring. The Bling Ring was one of my favorite movies of the year, mainly because it was such a strong deconstruction of privilege in this society. This movie is one that actually I was a little nervous of, but then when I saw it, I absolutely loved it. I either love her movies or I hate them, and that's just the way it is, and this is the one that I loved. Now, what's interesting about this is the big change that they do on this, based on the, because otherwise it parallels the original movie pretty well. The big change they do is they don't give any backstory to the soldier's character. Now, the Clint Eastwood character, he's a scoundrel, he's a deserter, he's a murderer, and he's telling lies just to set himself up in a good position. So there's a lot more, it's much more of a Clint Eastwood movie. This movie's not about the soldier who's played by Colin Farrell, it's about the women and their response. So what the women know is what we know, and that is it. And that's an interesting approach, because we don't get whether or not he's telling the truth. We don't get whether or not he's a deserter or what his plan is or what his ulterior motives are. It's all from the girl's point of view or the women's point of view, which is fascinating, because that makes a very different movie. So even if you loved the first movie, it's an interesting watch, because you see it set up not at all from his point of view. And in that sense, what's funny is there's a thing called the Bechdel test. And what the Bechdel test basically says, the litmus test, is if there's at least one conversation between two women and have it not be about a guy and have it not have a guy involved in the conversation, then it passes the Bechdel test, which isn't completely a valid test, because pretty much there's a whole segment of pornography that passes the Bechdel test that I would hardly say is this big empowerment for women. But it's an interesting way to look at it. Now, this movie doesn't pass it, because every single conversation they have is about the soldier. But that's the point of the movie. It's not about women being empowered. It's about women living alone and girls living alone. And you have this introduced into their lives, this very provocative and interesting element, which is this wounded Civil War soldier and how everybody reacts. And they're sort of stair-stepped in age. They've got, girls as long, they look like they're about 10. all the way up to teenagers. You know, Elle Fanning plays, I'm assuming her character is about 17 or 18. And then you've got the one who runs the school, Nicole Kidman. And then you got Kirsten Dunst, who's in her 30s, playing one of the teachers. So you see each girl has a different reaction to him at a different stage in girlhood and womanhood. And that's what's so fascinating about it, is that it is this breakdown of obsession and sexual temptation. Now, what's interesting is, like I said, it didn't pass the Bechdel test, but it doesn't pass the anti-Bechdel test either. There are no scenes where two men have a conversation alone and not about a woman. Every conversation in this movie is either between women talking about him or him talking to the women. So in that Bechdel background, it's a movie that is about how the sexes interact and in such a trying time. And it also works as kind of an interesting thriller, although it is a bit of a slow burn. But I have to say, I really got into The Beguiled. I thought it was really good. I was surprised and I was happy that I liked it as much as I did. So yeah, The Beguiled totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Book of Henry. A genius 11-year-old lays out a map for his mother to take down their next-door neighbor who's been sexually molesting his stepdaughter.
This story, it's about me, my brother, my mom, and the girl who lived next door.
Henry and Peter, they're lucky to have you.
And your father's lucky to have you, too.
Stepfather.
There's only one way to stop it. I'd hope to do it all myself, but that's not an option.
Has to be another way to help Christina. Why, there's no way to help.
This movie actually came out a couple weeks ago, and it's been rolling around in limited release, and I wanted to review it because it's directed by Colin Trevorrow, who's best known now for doing Jurassic World, and of course he's going to be doing Star Wars. So all these eyes are on him. He started out like some people do, especially the ones that they're tapping for these Star Wars movies. And like I said, we'll talk about some Star Wars stuff later on. But people that are tapping for these Star Wars movies, they're coming from smaller, more intimate, more interesting productions, and they're not getting big blockbuster directors. Like Gareth Edwards, he did Godzilla, but before he did Godzilla, he did Monsters, which was this very small Mexican film that was very small budget. And so this is Colin Trevorrow going to a smaller movie. Now, it's got like bigger names to it. It's got like Naomi Watts as the mother, and you've got Jacob Tremblay, who was the kid from Room. So there's some recognizable names and faces in this movie. But overall, it's a smaller, more intimate, independent production. It goes back a bit to Colin Trevorrow's Safety Not Guaranteed, which is a great little movie. There's a lot of good intentions behind The Book of Henry. I certainly feel like people are trying to tell a great story and trying to pull the heartstrings and trying to get people behind the characters. But the problem with The Book of Henry is it's got about four or five different stories it's trying to tell. Different types of movies. On one hand, it's trying to tell this story about this awkward and genius kid who's dealing with his life and what it's thrown at him. It's also telling this sort of suspense story about what to do about the girl next door who's being molested by her stepdad. It's also this sort of whimsical comedy at times with these two brothers trying to get along in this bizarre little world they live in. It's possible to make a movie that hits all these emotional points, but it felt like these were like three or four different movies. And they just taped them together. They didn't like blend them together. So it keeps jarringly shifting tone and shifting focus as who's the characters and who are we paying attention to. And there's a lot to this movie that I said, you know, if they just remove this element, it would simplify the story and make it flow so much better. But for whatever reason, they try to cram everything in and it just doesn't work. And that makes the more heartfelt stuff corny. And that makes the suspense stuff seem out of place compared to all of that. None of this movie works together. I mean, look, Naomi Watts does a great job in it, but it just doesn't work. And there's these logic holes in it that the problem is I understand movies have logic holes in them all the time. That's fine. Lord knows Transformers has so many logic holes in it. You could drop an entire Transformer into it. But for a movie like The Book of Henry, which hinges upon this kid having been able to predict everything that's going to happen, you can't hinge on something that is so easily given to chance. And there's so much of that in the film, and I can't really talk about it because it would spoil it. But yeah, it just, these things don't work. If you start thinking too much about it, it completely collapses like a house of cards. So the Book of Henry kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I now will finally be talking about my thoughts on the Han Solo movie, weekly box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment of the show. I moved this news segment to the final segment simply because I didn't think I'd have enough room to talk about this earlier in the show, especially when I had a lot to say about Carrie Fisher. But there's another piece of Star Wars news, and I'm sure people have heard about it by now. The directors for the Han Solo movie, which is in production right now, Lord and Miller, who of course did movies like 21 Jump Street and the Lego movie, they have been fired. The term fired, I mean, they left because of quote-unquote creative differences, but they've been essentially fired by Lucasfilm. And the reports are saying that there was the creative differences were mostly between Lord and Miller and Lawrence Kasdan, who is the writer, who is most famous for writing Empire Strikes Back. I mean, Kasdan has a history of Star Wars. He certainly does. The Han Solo that Lord and Miller were presenting was a little more humorous and a little more funny. And Kasdan's like, no, he's not overtly a funny guy. He's sarcastic, sure, but he's a scoundrel. And people lost their minds over this. I guess part of it is because of the love for Lord and Miller, and they've done some great stuff in the past. But I remember when I heard that they were set for this movie, I said, this might be a problem. Because most of the movies they do are, at their heart, comedies. And that's not what we want in a Han Solo movie. I mean, great example, like Lego Batman. I loved Lego Batman. I thought the Lego Batman movie was fantastic. But I don't want that, and that level of humor and irreverence and goofiness and silliness in the movie The Batman that Ben Affleck's going to be in. I think that'd be a huge mistake, because we'd be going from what we've always wanted with, and what we had got from the Nolanverse was this serious look at Batman where you actually took it seriously and with an adult's eyes. We'd be going back to the stuff from Joel Schumacher with nipples on the bat suit and goofiness and silliness and over the top antics. And I don't necessarily think we need that. I mean, the Lego Batman movie did it great, but I don't know if I want to see a live-action Batman movie like that, and that's kind of how I feel about Han Solo. Han Solo is, at his heart, a dramatic character. And while he is the deliverer of many humorous and laugh-out-loud lines throughout the series of Star Wars, he's not mugging for the camera. His lines are funny because of the way they fall. Sort of like the droid that Alan Tudyk plays in Rogue One. He's hilarious. That droid is funny. But the reason that droid's funny is because of how the lines land, not because the robot's a goofball. Now, they're bringing in Ron Howard to take over, and I know there's a lot of people, especially like sort of like the millennial age, people who maybe weren't alive and didn't see the original Star Wars movies on the big screen. There seems to be a rift here where they're like, oh, and they wanted to see what Lord and Miller would do. But Ron Howard taking over is sort of like, oh, dad's coming home kind of thing. Well, first of all, Ron Howard's a fantastic director. Sure, he's directed some crap in his time. But he's a great director, but he can also work with a studio. And it's not that he's taking the studio's bidding, but he's working with the studio. You know, a Maverick only works so far, but a Maverick can really take it out off the beaten path. You saw this happen with Ant-Man. where Edgar Wright was developing Ant-Man, and it was going looked like it was going to be going into production, and eventually he's no longer doing it. And then they brought in somebody else. And a lot of people said, well, you're a shill to the studio. It's like, no, because Marvel has a certain vision on how they want these movies to be. So you can't come in there and just make it your own thing, which is, I think, one of the problems with the DC universe, where you had Zack Snyder come in and try and, you know, basically dictate how all these DC movies are going to look. And that's not a good look. Maybe for Batman, but not for everybody. And so Lord and Miller, I think they were trying to go a little too goofy, a little too silly. And we've had two Star Wars movies come out so far. We're still very young in this extended franchise. So if Lucasfilm is playing it safe, that's their prerogative. And I'm fine with that. Because they're also giving the backstory of a character, and they don't want goofy stuff going on. They don't want it to be a comedy. And I support their decision. I think Ron Howard taking over is going to be a great thing. I think we're going to have one heck of a movie. You know, they brought somebody in for reshoots for Rogue One because Gareth Edwards wasn't doing exactly what they wanted. You can sit there and complain all you want about selling out, but this is how movies work. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office here for a second. Last week I said Cars 3 was good for $60 million. It was lower than that. It had about $53 million, which is really low for Cars. And I actually responded to somebody on Twitter. And what I said this last week was I said, even if it's a low number for Cars, these movies make billions of dollars in merchandising. The only reason they're making more car movies is so that they have a reason to continue making the merchandise and make the merchandise fresh in kids' minds. That's where the real money is. So yeah, is that a great number for Cars? No, it's the lowest of the three movie series. And it's pretty low for Pixar. I believe it's the lowest on Pixar's docket as well. But that's okay, because it's a longer end game than that. All Eyes on Me, they thought it was going to do extremely well, and it did okay with $26.5 million. But it got to a high, fast start at the beginning because it came out on Tupac's birthday and slowed by the weekend. 47 Meters Down made a pretty good $11 million opening. And then Rough Night was a little bit rough with $8 million. This week, I think obviously Transformers is going to win because it's the one new movie, but right now it's clocking in at close to about $65 million for the 5-day. That's from Wednesday or Tuesday night through Sunday. $65 million for the 5-day, which basically means it's probably going to be in the 40s for the 3-day. That is awful, considering the last movie struggled to just barely crack $100 million its opening weekend. And even then, I don't believe that number. I think that was a little bit fudged just to bump it over the $100 million mark back in 2014. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Before I talk about the other movies that are out on DVD and Blu-ray, I want to go back 3 years to 2014 in the summer when Dawn of the Planet of the Apes came out. Let's take a look at this movie because we got the new one coming out in a couple weeks, and it's worth going back and watching this movie. There's a lot of stuff you're going to want to refresh with this film. In this sequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the simian virus has killed off most humans. Now Caesar and his apes clash with one of the few remaining human colonies near San Francisco.
Apes do not want war!
We both have families. You want to protect yours, I want to protect mine.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
If you threaten his family, he will retaliate.
Don't shoot! What are you doing?
I'm saving the human race.
War has begun.
If you really want to break these apes movies out, I mean, if you talk about this in the trilogy, the first one's kind of its own thing. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes works more as a 1-2 opening movie and sequel with War for the Planet of the Apes. They really feel like they're cut from the same cloth. So if you're going to go see War for the Planet of the Apes in a couple weeks, it would not hurt to go back and rewatch Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. First of all, it's a good movie. It's better than I remember. When I first saw it, and the only time I had seen it before I rewatched it this week, the only other time I'd seen it was in a drive-in, which is not a good time to see a movie and really, you know, for a movie, especially a movie like this, that's a little more cerebral and dense. And also it's a very dark movie because it takes place in the woods and it's in this place where they have a lot of torchlight. This is the plan, the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. It has some rough edges, and most of the rough edges come from the human side. I found it fascinating watching the apes developing their society. It does have a lot of things to say about loyalty and sacrifice and war, because this is the buildup to the start of the war. And if anything, this shows a real truth of life that you can't really trust anyone, that you can't trust somebody just because they're human or just because they're ape. And you can't not trust somebody for the, so those same reasons. The biggest problem with this movie is the people get in the way. And while they're necessary to have in there and they have good performances, the real stars of the movie are the apes. And if anything, this should whet your appetite for War of the Planet of the Apes, which comes out next month. But in the end, I have to say, going back and revisiting Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, beyond the visual technology and the visual effects, it's just a good, solid movie that adds to the Planet of the Apes lore. And it's worth checking out, especially, like I said, if you're going to see the sequel. Ultimately, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The other movies that are coming out this week on DVD and Blu-ray, we've got Life, which is about the alien on the spaceship that kills people. Wilson, with Woody Harrelson playing a misanthropic writer trying to reconnect with his daughter who was given up for adoption. And then new Blu-rays of The Lawnmower Man and Joe versus the Volcano. Two very, very fun movies from the 80s and 90s that are goofy as all get out, but still kind of nostalgic fun for me. That is it. I need to go for the week. And when I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Despicable Me 3 and Baby Driver. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.